Welcome to the Holden Village Podcast. Holden is a community of education, programming, and worship located in the remote wilderness of the Cascade Mountains. These snapshots provide a glimpse into the learnings taking place in our community. Let's tune in to this week's highlight.
Hello, I'm Jeff Pierce. I'm Holden's volunteer fire marshal. I've been coming up here since I was a little kid, and this was like a second home to me. And after I got into the fire service, it just seemed to be a real natural fit that I would use those skills to help Holden. But, you know, I'm not the only one that works on the fire systems. Today, we've also got our fire tech with us, Danny.
Yeah, I'm Danny Pavic. I have been the fire tech here at Holden for about 10 months now, and I signed on to stay for another year. I heard about Holden Village. I'm a Northfield native, Northfield, Minnesota, and Holden Village just has a really solid connection with Northfield and St. Olaf College. And through my upbringing, I heard about Holden Village, and I always thought it was kind of cool, but this was really my first opportunity to come out here and see what this place was all about.
Right on. You know, my experience goes back to when I was a child. My family in the late 60s started coming up to Holden. And as a little kid, I thought that all of the work they were doing on the buildings and stuff was just part of some remodel project. And I didn't realize they were actually just putting the place back into service so that it could be a retreat center.
Okay. Danny, are there any questions you want?
Yeah. So the whale is the village's way of letting everybody know there's some sort of emergency somewhere in the village. When the whale goes off, it goes off over horns that are audible from just about anywhere in the village. And then somebody comes onto a microphone and says where, what building is relevant to this alarm. And when that happens, that's where all of the villagers go to respond. Everybody has a different hat that they wear when the whale goes off. We have searchers and hose house people, and there's the medic responds in a certain way in this case.
Yeah, that's great, Danny. But what causes the whale even to go off? Because the whale is what everybody hears. It's what the community, the guest, that's what they know because it's a siren. And it's disruptive, but what causes it to go off?
So there are a myriad of things that can cause the whale to go off in any of the buildings. Each of the buildings has a fire alarm panel and smoke detectors and heat detectors and strobe horns connected to it. And when one of those smoke or heat detectors gets tripped, that sends a signal to the fire alarm panel in that building, which then sends another signal to Gertrude and the whale, and that's what sets off the whale.
There's a reason Gertrude is called Gertrude, and I don't know if you're aware of this, but Gertrude Lungholm, she used to make a statement like, "May the spirit disturb you." And Rich Wilson, who has been a monumental help to the village with its electrical systems and the load control, he remembered Gertrude, and he's like, we need to name the panel that makes the whale go off Gertrude after her. And I was like, I can't argue with the logic, you know. In the early years, it would go off all the time. And I can remember people telling me that when you went out of the village and came back, standard question was, how often has the whale been going off? In the early systems, the fire alarm system here at the village had one setting, alarm. And it would trip out at an alarm and the whale would go off and the whole community would be disrupted and show up for this event. And it would be low pressure in our sprinkler systems, or it would be steam from, and that's the classic one that people remember with the bus arrival is open the vent up in the shower or the fire brigade will be joining you. And I'm really happy to say that doesn't happen anymore.
I kind of feel like I've covered most of what I would want to.
Okay.
I think I'm going to bow out.
All right.
But
all right, thanks.
So Jeff, why doesn't the whale go off as much?
Well, I, for one, don't like getting woke up in the middle of the night, even though my career, that was a standard at the fire station. As I started to work on the systems here, I basically sought out ways of improving the system and eliminate those nuisance alarms. And so one of the pieces that we hadn't talked about yet was we connected a pager system to the Gertrude. When that low pressure in the sprinkler system reaches a point that concerns us, we get what we call a trouble page. Danny and I and the ops manager will be the only people that are woke up because of this low pressure. And we've even got the system wired. If somebody leaves a door open to the sprinkler valve room and it's freezing outside, we'll get a trouble alarm that tells us that it's reaching freezing conditions and we need to go solve that problem. But it's just us that are disrupted, not the entire community.
Yeah, so you fine-tuned.
A lot of fine-tuning and, you know, changing out and adding equipment to the system. It's become actually pretty complex.
Has the whale been here since the beginning?
Not since the beginning, but I do remember reading some old archive material in our files about purchasing it. And I'm trying to remember, but I believe there was an event where they had, and it may have actually been when Chalet 2 caught fire and burned down. I could be wrong on this, but you know, Chalet 2, when it caught fire, there was no advance warning. And there was a very, very few staff wintering over that year. Literally, one of the women noticed fire coming out a window of the chalet. And by that time, it was too late. As I recall, that was a trigger where they started researching and installing heat detectors in the village. And back then, it was a very simple, rudimentary type of system.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the biggest thing that I realized, I don't think I've ever seen in another spot, is the rain bird. And it was just mentioned by Glenn tonight how thankful he was when he was evacuated at Wolverine Fire 2015, that you were so adamant in getting those installed. And I've never even heard of or seen a rain bird.
I wish I could tell you that the idea was strictly mine out of the thin blue, but it wasn't. There's other communities where I've never seen them on the scale that we have utilized, but the rain birds, as you call them, and actually rain birds is a trademark, and ours are made by a different manufacturer than rain birds. So technically, they are Nelson Big Gun rain birds. And I like the fact that it's their big gun. You know, when the Forest Service was here, you know, during the Domke fire, they put their little impact sprinklers on the roofs of the buildings, and they're like what you would have around your house, little bitty things. And the fire service, they type everything. A big fire engine that shows up to your house because it's on fire, that's a type 1 fire engine. But they have pickup trucks with 150 gallons of water and a hose reel. Well, that's a type 6. Okay. All right. Those little rain birds that the Forest Service put up, those are type 6. And to be honest, they weren't cutting it. But our rain birds, they're type 1s. And in fact, the incident commander on the Wolverine fire commented, he said, that's a type 1 sprinkler head. And I've just run with it ever since. When the fire and the incident is the biggest, baddest event around, and you need your A team, you call the Type 1 Incident Command Team. And we have Type 1 Rainbirds. You know, essentially what the big guns are, they were produced for agriculture. We've all seen them out in the farms, sprinkling the crops and everything. And it's a technology that's adapted to protect structures and communities. So we took that idea. And Christopher Gillie when he was the operations manager, approached me and said...
When was it?
2004. Christopher asked me, he said, we are thinking about putting in a raw water system for lawns and gardens. If we did that, could we use it for fire protection? And I said, absolutely. But I said, the caveat is you got to put in a big pipe. And so we started planning and doing research. A few years later, we had the Domke fire. Craig Edberg had been helping us with doing the research, and he found a company in Oregon that sold these big guns on a tripod. And he facilitated the purchase of these things. The fire's burning. I run down to this company, pick up the four Rainbirds, bring them up to Holden, and set them up. And we could get three to work, because our underground water system just didn't have the pipe size and the volume to do more than three of these sprinklers.
Where's the water coming from?
Well, today it comes out of our penstock. Copper Creek. So the water comes down Copper Creek into the diversion dam, into the penstock, which feeds the hydro. And we have a 6-inch tap into the penstock to pull that water out and charge a 6-inch loop of pipe that encircles the village. And we then have a vault where we place these sprinklers in the vault. And there's 17 of them in and around the village. What I love about this system, though, because there's so much pressure in the penstock, we did a full test while SciTech was up here. It's a village committee. The committee members, you know, one by one, turned on all their sprinklers, and we're monitoring the pressure. And every time they turn on a sprinkler, we'd see a little drop, and then the pressure would come back up. And it'd turn on another, pressure would drop a little bit and come back up. Well, at the penstock, there's a pressure reducing valve. And every time we asked for more water, it opened the valve a little bit more. And at the end of it, we had 17 Rainbirds running, 1,700 gallons of water flowing, and we dropped one PSI. It was beyond my wildest expectations. And we created this dome of humidity. So during the Wolverine fire, I went to fire camp and ran into the operations chief that's going to basically run the fire. And it's a man I've worked for before. And he's like, Jeff, you're off station. We're flying you back. And I was like, great. I appreciate that immensely. And he said, Jeff, I only know one way to save the village. And I know where he's going. And he says, we need to put a ring of black around it. And I'm like, I'm with you. I said, I can create a dome of humidity and we can put the hot shots right in the village and protect in place. And he's like, let's get her done. So remember I mentioned Craig Edberg. He helped us design the system. Well, 2 weeks after Chris Schultz had been assigned to a different fire, he runs into Craig Edberg, who's a safety officer on the same fire. And they get to talking. Chris says, Craig, when I was dispatched to the Wolverine fire, I had written Holden off. So I was not going to put firefighters on a dead-end road. And he said, when we got up to fire camp, they told us your big gun Rainbirds were operational. He says, I saw them during the Domke fire, and I knew you were going to do it, but I didn't know it was operational. So once I heard it was fully operational, we talked it over with the operations chief, decided, well, let's fly the fire and figure out if we can come up with a plan. And they decided that they would insert two hotshot crews, Silver City and Antioch hotshots, and a branch director to come up here and run the show from here with a plan to slowly bring fire up to the village. So they literally flew up to the ridge tops with these ping pong balls, which were filled with a flammable powder, and they inject it with glycol solution, I believe, And then the dispenser drops these things out of the helicopter, like four at a time, but at a rapid rate. When they hit the ground, they're flaming. And so they literally created this three-sided box. One side of that box is actually the down valley side of Railroad Creek. And the ridge lines are the other two sides. Reggie Bray, the branch director, flies up there and, you know, drops these spherical pyrotechnic devices and starts essentially backfiring and slowly bringing the fire down and around the village in a controlled fashion. The concern was if the fire was left to its own course, it would slowly burn up each drainage and then run up the drainage. So by burning from the top of the drainage down over several days, we controlled the fire behavior. Once they got closer to the village, the hot shots would go up to the fire and meet it, and then with drip torches, work the fire down around the village. They timed it so that they reached the village perimeter at 8 o'clock in the evening. When the temperatures are dropping, the humidities are going up. They're burning the fuel out for it. And we're all standing around the back of the chalets, taking pictures and watching what they're doing. And it's really minimal fire behavior. And the unique thing was, is around that area, around the perimeter of the village, after the fuel from their drip torches burned out, the fire would go out. The next day, in the morning briefing, Reggie looks over at me and he says, "Jeff, no rainbirds. We need to clean up our black." The three rainbirds that we had running in the evening produced enough humidity, in addition to the normal humidity increase, to extinguish the fire on the perimeter of the village. And that's a risk to a wildland firefighter of it reburning. So they had to go back and clean that all up. So they had nice, clean black that could not reignite and threaten the village.
That was 2015 when the rainbirds were the first time fully operational.
Right.
When, yeah, like the timing of it was
phenomenal, because we had a functional system a month before the lightning strike that started Wolverine Fire. And at that point, we still actually didn't have a fully functioning system. If you remember, we had mine remediation going on. They were working on the south side of the creek, and we did not have a pipe that went from the footbridge up to the penstock where we were going to connect. That had not been installed yet. In the spring, we were looking at a severe drought. The spring was hotter than normal. We had record-breaking number of 90-plus degree weather early in the summer, late spring. I basically looked at the Holden leadership and I said, we are not going into fire season in a drought year with record temperatures with an 80% complete system that's just waiting for a water source. We came up with renting a large trailered pump run off a diesel motor. I can remember sitting in a meeting and one of the managers looked over at me and said, "This is a lot of money. Are we really going to do this?" And I said, "We absolutely are, because of the before mentioned reasons. We need this pump."
Yeah.
And they said, "Okay."
Through that summer, you had that pump rented. Where did the water come from then? Railroad?
Railroad Creek.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow. Well, maybe you could talk to how this year's fire season compares to other previous fire seasons, or, I mean, fires are happening all over the West Coast.
They are. I mean, this year, 2020, we have seen phenomenal fire behavior up and down the West Coast. This fire season started out kind of light. There, you know, the summer was mild. You know, we weren't getting a lot of fires in the Northwest. And then end of August, things really heated up, dried out. Our fuel moistures really dropped. So basically dry forest. And then we had a windstorm. You know, I was doing some reading here this week on an article that talked about the vapor pressure density. And it essentially is a scale of how dry the air is. And this monitoring that they do in the scale at the time that these big fires took off was record-setting dryness. What the scale does is it shows essentially how dry the air is and its propensity to pull moisture out of things like the soil, the wood on your house. Another measure that we use is, you know, how dry our dead fuels are. So a stick on the ground that's 1 inch to 3 inch in diameter, that's a 100-hour fuel. And at the end of August, they were getting down into the 5% level. Okay. To put that in perspective, the wood you go buy at the lumber yard, kiln-dried wood, normal, is 12% dryness. And the forest was at 5%. And then you add these super dry winds that are pulling whatever moisture is left in the vegetation and the ground out of it. This is the kind of stuff when you look at your plants and it's like, I've been watering, but it looks wilted today. Phenomenal dryness. And then the wind blew. And we had all of these mega fires happening up and down the coast and the mountains and stuff. And to put, again, the wildfire into perspective, you know, those are all mega fires. There was a mega fire, the North Complex fire in California, 200,000 acres in 24 hours. All right. That's essentially, if a mega fire is considered anything over 100,000 acres, over the course of its entire life, a month of burning, it might reach 100,000 acres. North Complex does 2 megafires in 24 hours. All right, just phenomenal fire behavior and burning. So looking at some data points, I noticed another article showed megafires. In the 20th century, there were 6. Since 2000, 20 years, we've had 16 megafires. Just in the United States, we've had 5 of them in the last month. Things are changing in the world.
Those are some solid statistics. That's amazing. Have you ever talked to Sid?
Sid is he's an amazing mountain. He's one of the last remaining mountain men. It's a phenomenal how often I run into him on the boat. And I love to go talk to him.
Yeah.
And he has a really interesting perspective on things. And it's like, it's really tragic what happened to him in the Wolverine fire.
I listened to him explain that Forest Service practices in terms of letting fires run their course, that's becoming more something that happens more often. Whereas in the old days, it was much more, you know, fires were fought a lot, much more put out.
We could talk a whole nother podcast about that. There's a phenomenal book, 1910, Fire That Changed America. And it is about one of the biggest mega fires the Northwest has ever seen. I think it started in Montana, burned through Idaho. This is the fire where Pulaski became famous because at gunpoint, he held his crew in a cave and saved them from a wildfire.
Just read about this.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story.
Yeah. And is that the same Pulaski that the tool is named after?
It is the same man.
And a couple of people died in the cave.
They did, right? From asphyxiation, yes. And I think there was a horse in there or two that died too. I mean, they barely made it out.
Pulaski survived.
He's actually a tragic story. I think he was burned, had some health issues after it. And, you know, everybody just kind of left him. He never fully recovered. But the fire changed our thinking. Gifford Pinchot was good buddies with Teddy Roosevelt, if I remember the story correctly. They basically said, we need to protect the forest. And so they went to Congress and said, if you give us a forest service, we will put rangers in the forest and they will put the fires out by 10 o'clock the next day. And I read that in the book and I'm like, that's the tipping point. It started in the beginning. Congress had a large number of lumber barons and they were like, oh, you're going to protect our trees. Sign the bill. And they started putting out these fires. Well, they did such a great job of it that the forest grew up. The fuels got so heavy that when you get a major fire, it just nukes everything in the area. I just saw a picture from, I saw posted from one of my old fire chiefs of Eastern Oregon. And it shows an area, a road. And it shows this one side of the road, no fuel treatments. Fuel is vegetation in our world. So that fuel untreated, every single tree is burned up. On the other side of the road, they've reduced the fuels. The canopy is open. There's very little ladder fuels on the ground. The fire hits the road, it's out of the tree canopy. Where they've done the fuel treatments, there's still tons of trees there. It's not nuked anymore. Well, where they did the fuel treatment, more accurately represents what that forest would look like if we allowed fire to do its normal thing. Paul Hessenberg, local U.S. Forest Service researcher, had come up to Holden a couple of years ago and gave us a presentation on mega fires. Google Paul Hessenberg on YouTube. It's all there. And he's given presentations to Congress on mega fires. And he talks in there about how the Indians would burn the forest to improve their hunting grounds and everything like that. But they did it in a way that was produced healthy fires. They would start fires in the spring while there was still snow on the ground in places. So it would burn in patches where the snow had melted. Back then we had healthy forests. Now we have unhealthy forests. And then you add a global change in our weather patterns to warmer, and the fact that there's a lot more humans on this earth using the forests. And, you know, this last month, if you look at where a lot of these big mega fires started, they're all places where there's human infrastructure, power lines, or campers and other people. You know, I don't know today what started most of the fires.
Gender reveal party.
That was one of them. And unfortunately, I just learned today that a firefighter was killed on the El Dorado fire. That was a gender reveal party. And that's the tragicness of the human impact that we have on the forest, is it can lead to tragedy. A lot of people died in the Northwest this last month because of these mega fires. So we really do need to think about how do we manage the forest. When I bring it back to Holden and I think we don't want fire in this valley, then I think fire was the natural way to disturb the ecosystem and remove those fuels. We don't want fire. Well, then if we're going to be good stewards of this land, then shouldn't we remove some of that fuel and reduce that as being good stewards? And we've done that. We've, you know, around the village, we've created defensible space. And now the piles down the road, now the story there is post Wolverine fire, we had all of this, what we call heavy fuel. So all of these big snags that burned and died during the fire. And post-fire, the bugs get into the trees and attack them and kill even more trees. So you have all this dead standing wood and it starts to fall down. So we have heavy fuels on the ground. The road is our escape route. Kyle Cannon, the fire management officer, is like, this is a problem for Holden. Their escape route has all of these heavy fuels on it. We need to reduce that fuel mass. Rio Tinto then, because they've got the heavy equipment, they piled mechanically a lot of that heavy fuel along the road. And then the Forest Service came back in the fall when it was safe to burn and burned those piles.
Okay. Any future things for Holden related to fire safety?
So for the future, for Holden, I'm feeling we've done a lot for our wildfire protection. There's still things that we can do to our structures. You know, the skirts got lots of big knot holes in them where the embers can fly through them, cracks in them. We've got a plan to replace those skirts and make sure the embers can't get in underneath them. Walk around the buildings, and sometimes you can see, you know, during the Wolverine fire, I showed the structure protection supervisor a picture of one of the chalet porches, and there was a pile of kindling, and you could see the daylight coming through all of the boards. And Rusty looks at me and he says, well, I hope you remove that kindling. And he says, no, you don't understand. All of our porches and basements are full of kindling and woody material and storage. And he's like, oh, we'll start wrapping them tomorrow. And then they put this aluminum foil around all the skirts. Okay. Well, they had 6 days to do that work. Yeah. I don't know that we'll have 6 days at the next fire. So there's things yet that we can do for wildfires. Now, when it relates to structure fires, you know, that's a whole nother story. We have been installing sprinklers in the chalets the last 3 years. More fire protection has helped us with design and installing them. Our first three chalets, and then Charlie Dixon, an angel of the village. He's been helping me fit the chalets with sprinklers following, you know, more fire protection's design. You know, got to give them credit. They're like, whatever you need, we're here to help you guys out. Well, we've got 4 more chalets to do and Narnia. And then the entire village will have sprinkler systems. And sprinklers are the number one way to protect people from a structure fire. That'll be a huge benchmark when we finish that. After that, if you remember, I said one of our oldest fire systems is the Whale. Mm-hmm. It's basically 200 amp car amplifiers for music systems powered by a car battery. It's totally an unlisted, unapproved fire system. Well, we need to replace that with a mass communication system, evacuation system that will better integrate with our pager system and allow us to reliably notify the staff and the guest of an emergency. My vision for the future, the Whale goes off at 2 o'clock in the morning and the only ones that know are the staff.
You know, I just recalled the leftover from the mine or the hose houses.
Right.
That's the other old fire protection, that's probably the longest running, because all of those hose houses were installed during the mining days.
They were. We have
upgrades to those?
Well, when we, you know, during the mine remediation work, we put in new water lines, which included new fire hydrants. Okay. Our old system, we really needed a new water system terribly. We literally moved the firehouses a few feet onto new fire hydrants. But in those hose houses, we also have them plumbed with the raw water system. Now we can switch from the potable water and move those fire hoses over to the non-potable water. And then we've got water as long as it's flowing through the penstock.
To prevent it from jumping to another...
to another building. Yeah, last thing we want is a hold in conflagration.
Bar that we don't have actual firefighter, you know, that can come and put out the fire, there's a lot of things in place to mitigate.
There is a lot of things. You know, I'll never forget one time I was listening to my fire chief, who went on to become the president of the International Fire Chiefs Association, Jeff Johnson, amazing leader. He used to tell people, when you call 911, in 4 to 8 minutes, you get 4 highly trained professionals on $500,000 of rolling stock. And in 10 minutes, in most cases, they mitigate your emergency and drive into the wind. That's damn good government service. We don't have that at Holden Village. We have to rely on fire alarms that are sensitive enough that they actually give us a warning notification before there's flaming ignition. The last few actual potential property loss events were electrical, and just the smoke from the hot electrical stuff or the electrical burning inside the metal box was enough to set off the smoke detector. And our searchers just had to turn off the power. If it gets beyond that, having a sprinkler system that can control the fire, those are the things that we have to do. We have to take responsibility for the fact that that highly trained group of professionals in rolling stock, they're not coming, that we have to take personal responsibility and do whatever we can to create that positive outcome. And that's early detection and a reasonable, appropriate response to deal with that emergency. And for us, it's getting people there within 2 minutes, because after 2 minutes, a structure fire in today's buildings with furniture that's built with petroleum products, in 3 minutes, there's so much hot gases and smoke that nobody's going to survive it. There's no way that Holden's going to put it out. Sprinklers break that. They control the fire before it reaches that point.
Well, thanks, Jeff, for everything that you've put into the village to help it keep being safe, and the future work that you do, and all the questions that you've answered, and all the knowledge you've shared. I think there's a lot of fascinating topics that people will get from this.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to share some insights with you and share my thoughts. I appreciate the stout that you brought over. Oh, this is a Holden brew,
yeah,
and
yeah.
It's excellent. And I really hope that the people listen to this, you know, get a little bit of useful information for their own safety and use.
Thanks for joining us. Be sure to view the links in the description for more information, or visit our website to find out more about the village. We hope you will make a pilgrimage to Holden. Blessings and peace to you.